This is Seeking Delphi, episode number 42, Going to Mars, featuring Moriba Jha. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. Mars, Mars, Mars. NASA wants to go there. Elon Musk wants to go there. He wants to die there. Late in his life, Stephen Hawking advocated that we must become a multi-planet species if we are to survive. Well, if not Mars first, then where? But can it happen? Will it happen? I recently spoke with somebody who knows a few things about the challenges of going to Mars. He should. Moriba Jha was the navigator for several of NASA's unmanned missions to Mars. Here's what he had to say. My guest today is Moriba Jha. He is an associate professor of aerospace engineering and engineering mechanics at the University of Texas and former NASA engineer. Moriba, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You've got some interesting stuff on your resume. We're talking about going to Mars, and you know a little bit about that, having been a navigator on several of the NASA Mars missions. So just for a couple of minutes, tell us your history on that, how you got into it, and what that entails.
Yeah, so basically at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, one of their missions is robotic exploration of the solar system. And I was able to get a job in the navigation and mission design section there back in like 1999 as I was going into grad school. And the job itself is really focused on how to use measurements collected about where objects are in the sky to figure out where these things have been and help predict where they're going to go. And so a spacecraft navigator's job is really to say, listen, we have this ideal path where we want the objects, the satellites to go. And we know that life is imperfect. We have imperfect measurements and there's some elements of randomness scattered in there. And so given where the path that we want to be on, where are we? And then how do we get back onto that ideal path? And so the navigation team is really all about taking these measurements from these huge radio dishes on how far the satellite is and how fast it's moving away, sort of thing. And from that, doing the Sherlock Holmes activity of really trying to understand how this spacecraft is behaving and using that understanding to maximize the ability to accurately, you know, predict where the satellite's going to go.
In a bit, I'd like to get to talk about going to Mars with human beings, but clearly there's a good bit more that NASA's going to, and others are going to be doing before that happens. And I'm curious if you've been following and see what's on the horizon in terms of unmanned flights in the next few years. I know there's been an announcement of a mission to bring back a sample from Mars scheduled for the 2030s by, of course, Elon Musk has talked about it being there already with people by then. But what more can we learn from unmanned messages besides pure science in terms of preparing to send people to Mars? Is there more to it that we have to learn, you know, other than the engineering challenges?
So I think the engineering challenges definitely are probably first and foremost. But, you know, look, we humans have evolved on this third, you know, rock from the sun that has a lot of water, has a nice dense atmosphere, has a global magnetic field, has a really large moon that orbits every 28 days that regulates our lives, certainly cycles, you know, for women and that sort of stuff. Mars lacks all this stuff. So you know, my question is, just because we want to be on Mars doesn't mean that we can. And I think that robotic missions have a lot to provide in terms of helping us fill out the gap of, is this something that's even possible biologically? I mean, even if you shield yourself from radiation, have air to breathe, find a way to do that, find a way to thrive with food in such a scarce environment, look, just the whole moon thing by itself and the lack of a global magnetic field, that's going to have an impact. on our biological systems in one way or another. And I don't know that that's known well at this time, like what that impact might be. So I suspect some things we're going to have to learn along the way, and it's certainly not going to be in the absence of the loss of human life. Like, exploration historically has costed lives, and to think that we could find ways to settle human beings on Mars in the absence of that, I think is naive at best.
Clearly then, though, the biological challenges are substantial, but it's more than just radiation. We don't know how we're going to deal, for example, with, you know, there's 9 months of microgravity getting there, but then there's low gravity living there. You know, Elon Musk is talking about colonizing Mars, but we really have no idea what indefinite amounts of time and 40% gravity is going to do. Is there anything being done to try and study that, or is it just impossible?
I think that to some extent, experiments done on the space station might be crafted to give us some insight on that. But at the end of the day, you know, without actually being there and exposing people to that level of, I'm going to call them resistant forces, normal forces. Yeah, part of it is you have to learn it as you're there and as you experience some of these things. But we'd certainly like to minimize. We'd like to minimize the amount of on-the-job training as possible.
Well, and of course, there are attempts to simulate the environment of being Mars. Unfortunately, they really can't simulate the radiation exposure and the gravity, but for example, the isolation and the like. But I just recently saw that there have been experiments to do that on top of a volcano in Hawaii, and one of the recent groups only lasted 4 days. That doesn't portend pretty well. Are you aware of any such experiments that have been a little more successful? Because I know just the human isolation is going to be a problem.
Well, so part of these experiments, it's a little tongue-in-cheek sort of thing with me, because I look at the traditional ecological knowledge that comes from certain indigenous people. And people are trying to set up these isolated kind of experiments. It's like, look, just go talk to the Inuit in the Arctic. It's not like life has been easy for them. They've been very isolated. They've been thriving in environments with huge scarcity of resources and that sort of stuff. I don't know, go talk to, you know, the Aborigines, or go talk to other indigenous people that have been very isolated and had to thrive in very scarce resource environments. I don't see organizations that are scientific and technical are reaching out enough to indigenous people and respecting the fact that even though they don't have three letters behind their names, there's a lot that they've learned over millennia. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel on this.
That is an interesting viewpoint on that. Now, how about just in terms of getting people to Mars? I've always felt that, and of course, we've seen that Elon Musk is over-optimistic on many of the things that he has gone after. It's not surprising that he might be over-optimistic on that, but he has made some amazing progress with some of the SpaceX technology. But in the final analysis, biggest factor may be cost. I mean, is it realistic for him or for NASA to get to Mars by the 2030s with human beings?
So I see everything that Elon does through the lens of this kind of mantra that he has of, you know, humanity needs to be a multi-planet species. So even his Starlink satellites, you know, what he's invested there in terms of like global internet, how he looks to AI and automation for a lot of the technologies that he tries to develop. To me, it's almost like I see Elon's activities somewhat akin to Legos. It's like, you know, you can build some pretty interesting things with Legos or very simple things, but at the end of the day, these are fundamental building blocks that snap in a certain way. And it's up to the artiste to figure out how these things are connected. So to me, all of his technologies are part of this Lego set, the astronautical Lego set. And whatever people think he's doing to do stuff here on Earth, they should be rest assured that it's all really underlying this idea of having humanity experience life on other celestial spheres.
Well, you mentioned something of Elon's. I'll digress a little bit from Mars because I know it's something else you're concerned of, and that's his Starlink system, because I know that you're very much concerned about the proliferation of space junk and have been sort of leading a bit of a campaign to do something about that. So you use a phrase, tragedy of the commons, that's popular with futurists and economists as well. So tell us a little bit about your concerns in that area.
Yeah, so we have this growing population of so-called resident space objects. Right now, the largest public catalog or database of these things is maintained by U.S. Space Command. Now it was U.S. Stratcom, now recently U.S. Space Command. And let's say that they track around 26,000 objects, size of a softball, all the way to the space station. Given this 26,000, currently maybe 3,000 work, everything else is garbage. We don't launch things in random orbits. We're very purposeful with where we put objects, try to take advantage of nature as much as possible. So that means that we have highways in space, very specific ones. And as opposed to highways on Earth, where you have cleaning crews that are able to remove rubbish from the road and stuff when there's accidents. When accidents happen on these highways in space, they keep on going and they stay in these highways, but they can cross lanes with some level of randomness. And between SpaceX, OneWeb, and Amazon now with the Kuiper project, certainly SpaceX wants to launch the most of these objects. But we're talking about almost doubling the catalog of currently tracked objects in the next 5 to 10 years. So the other thing too is that we don't fully understand the effects and impacts of the space environment on how objects behave. We don't track things so precisely that we can predict where they're going to be like 2 weeks from now. So we have a problem with predictability. So I tell my students, if you want to know something, you have to measure it. And if you want to understand something, you have to predict it. And we don't share all the measurements. That means that our knowledge can't be as good as it could be. And certainly, because we have an inability to predict very accurately over long periods of time, that also says something about our lack of understanding. And, Elon likes to automate stuff. He's already automated his Starlinks. He's launching 60 of these things every few weeks. Here's one thing that I want to add. In all of my scientific experience so far, I've seen that Mother Nature likes to seek states of equilibrium. Do we know what the state of equilibrium is for these orbital highways? I would say that putting 60 things into, pumping those into the population every few weeks doesn't even give us enough time to know what state of normalcy and equilibrium actually is. So our space operations is out in front of the headlights, as it were, with regards to regulatory frameworks that can help maximize long-term sustainability of the environment for future generations. So these are my concerns.
And is there any solution to cleaning up that junk? Because obviously it's a hazard to anything that's in orbit up there. Or are we just kind of stuck with it?
Well, so we're mostly stuck with what's currently there. Thinking about cleaning up the current population comprehensively, I think that that's ludicrous. Like, there's no way we get there. So we have to some extent, we have to know how to live with the current population. We can behave in ways that don't promulgate creating a whole lot more of the debris. So we can do that. So debris mitigation, if everybody kind of adhered to some general tenets of how to mitigate debris, I think that would be very helpful. But then the removal part, the remediation, as they call it in the community, there are definitely people looking at that. I know the European Space Agency wants to retrieve this Vespa large piece of debris in like 2025 with clear space. So those are good things. But if you wanted to make a sizable dent in the current population, you'd have to retrieve many of these things every year. And we're talking about retrieving one of these things in 2025 because it is expensive to do. So I think debris mitigation, do everything possible to not create more of it, And, you know, for lack of a better term, we humans have learned how to live quite well in our own filth so far. And I think that's going to be true for a very long time.
All right. Well, let's just to get back to Mars. So obviously there are, it's a complicated situation with the economic cost, the human biological and psychological challenges, the physical engineering challenges. In your mind, do you have a realistic idea as to when we're going to get there, or is it just impossible to foresee?
Well, for one thing, I'd like to say this. If you look at exploration historically, great risks were taken in exploration, back to the loss of human lives and all these things. I feel that, in general, the public, and let's say for sure the U.S. taxpayers, have developed an allergy to any sort of activity that falls short of guaranteeing success. And so if you say, yeah, we're going to explore Mars, and we'd better be 100 or 99% successful, that is one of the main drivers of cost. So one of the main drivers of cost is having to guarantee all this success. And it also means that when we do explore, we're not really taking big leaps in the risk. We're basically doing the same thing that we did before and just incrementally making changes. At that pace, we've basically pushed out the ability to actually get people on the planet for the foreseeable future. I think if we wanted to get people to Mars and we were willing to assume almost any level of risk in doing so, we could probably send people to Mars next year if we wanted to do that. It's less about the actual cause, the economy, and more about the tolerance that we have, as humans have, to accepting risk. And it's like, is it okay for this new set of astronauts that got selected? Let's say they're the first people to go in like a couple years or whatever. How comfortable would we be knowing that it's highly likely that it would be like a one-way trip? Would we as people embrace that? And I'd say in today's society, the answer is no. We won't do that.
Well, that of course was always my concern. You know, I remember when Mars One, which I think is dead now, came out and looked for volunteers to go on a one-way trip to Mars. I was stunned at how many people actually volunteering to go to Mars. Like, what are you going to do when you get there? You know, right. watch Netflix on a 20-minute delay. It's going to be stark, raw survival, and there's nothing to do there but survive. So we'll see. Let's look, you know, even further out, because there have been some pretty wild plans out there in terms of like terraforming Mars. I mean, is that something that even remotely realistic or possible, even within this century, looking all the way out to the end of it?
I'm gonna be bold and say that the actual terraforming is possible to really get underway over the next century. The thing is, back to we as humans and looking at ethics and moral values and these sorts of things, would we as a humanity embrace that? And I would say by and large, the answer is no. Like, there are a group of people that would say, yeah, it's we as a humanity need to do this for survival. I will even put it in even more stark terms. You know, even though the pace of you know, birth rates and that sort of stuff maybe overall may be slightly decreasing, but look, we have a finite amount of land on the Earth. Even within that finite amount of land, there's even a more finite amount of land that can produce food for all of us. Humanity is increasing. You know, the number of humans is increasing as a function of time, whether the rate is slowing down or whatever, population is in growth. I don't see that changing unless there was some major cataclysmic event, but barring these kind of one-off things, the trend is that's not going to stop. So if humanity wants to be a long-term species, there's no choice but to find ways to inhabit other places. And Mars just doesn't have all the things that we need. Ethically, are we okay again with changing the structure, the climate of Mars to make it more amenable to humans and life as we know it? I personally don't have ethical issues with that, but I know that many people do and will, religious and otherwise. So I think those are probably the harder barriers to actually get through versus technological ones.
Yeah, you're not the only one to talk about that either. You can go to Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, where he foresees a Mars where there is a political battle among Mars colonists about keeping Mars, quote, red and terraforming it. It's kind of not like there are any advanced Martians there that we know of that we're going to be hurting, but who knows? At any rate, I'd like to thank you for this. And I did also want to note that you are a fellow of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And there's a big conference coming up in November, the Ascend Conference. And I just wanted to remind everyone that this series in part is a lead up to the Ascend Conference, which will bring kind of everyone involved in space, both the governmental agencies and space commerce, all together in Las Vegas in November. And so I'm hoping maybe we'll get to see you there.
Yeah, so there's one thing that I could kind of add to this is if people could imagine what a TED conference focused on astronautics, space and stuff would be kind of on steroids. That's what Ascend is shaping up to be. So I'm looking forward to being a part of it and certainly able to kind of showcase a lot of the work that we're doing here at UT Austin regarding all these topics.
That sounds very interesting. I hope to be there myself. Maria, but thank you so much for joining me. Best of luck. And look forward to maybe seeing you at Ascend in November.
All right. Likewise, my brother. Thank you very much.
I particularly find the notion of studying isolated indigenous peoples a fascinating one. While going to Mars represents psychological and physical survival obstacles probably orders of magnitude more challenging than, say, the Arctic, those lonely Inuits just might be as close as we can come to finding a long-term terrestrial example. Honestly, though, money and human biology, in my view, remain the biggest problems. Listen for more interviews on the future of space exploration and exploitation leading up to the Ascend Conference in November. Links to that Ascend Conference and others relevant to this discussion can be found at www.seekingdelphi.com. You can subscribe to Seeking Delphi on Apple Podcasts, Player FM, YouTube, and other podcasting outlets. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.